In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who is well known for having written about mountain climbing. His name is David Roberts. He is the author of 17 books on mountaineering, as well as adventure and the history of the American Southwest. And he is a climber himself with quite a lot of experience. He began climbing while he was still in high school. He was president of the Harvard Mountaineering Club. He's contributed essays and articles to many publications, including National Geographic, National Geographic Adventure, Smithsonian, and the Atlantic Monthly, among others. And he's the author of a new memoir about his experiences climbing. The title of his book is On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined, in which he relates some of his experiences, including the fact that when he was quite young and early on in his climbing life, he was involved in three fatal climbing accidents. The first, in fact, happened when he was just 18 years old. And in this book, he reflects on these tragedies, some also of the close calls that he has had, and says that in spite of all of that, some of the greatest pleasures in his life have come when he has been climbing and has been in the mountains. And he explains very simply in the book that he's interested in trying to explore a couple of basic questions, one being why it is that people climb mountains and how they justify the risk and the inevitable, in his words, inevitable tragedy that climbing entails. The book is out now, On the Ridge Between Life and Death. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And if you would like to read the book, you can look for it in the bookstore. As we talked this morning with David Roberts, you're certainly welcome to call if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Now, again, in a local life, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, that number, 333-9455. And then the toll-free, anywhere you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, you can use that. Actually, even if people were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can also use that. That's 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Roberts, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I'm not quite exactly sure where to start in this book because there is so much. And I guess that really the thing that intrigued me right at the beginning when I even picked up the book was this question, why do we climb mountains? Why do people climb mountains? You certainly offer answers that come from your own personal experience, what it was that drew you to doing it and why you kept doing it. And I imagine that each individual who does it has himself or herself has an answer to that question, why they do it. Is it so, do you think, so personal to the individual? Or I know this is a sort of a cliche kind of question, you know, why do people climb mountains? But is it so personal, or is there some kind of answer that is that those people would share, that they would all sort of look at each other and nod and say, yes, we're feeling all the same thing?
Well, I think it's a critical question. It is personal. It's different for each climber. But for some reason, we as a brotherhood have been have answered it very poorly. You know, the most famous answer is Mallory's flippant, why did you want to climb Everest? Because it is there, he answered in a news conference. And people to this day argue whether he was making a joke or not. But why should it be such a hard question to answer? That's puzzled me ever since I started climbing. As you say, the answer I give in my book is a very personal one, and it has to do with my own psychological makeup. Mm. But it is the fundamental question about climbing, because it's so dangerous, because it has such serious consequences when things go wrong.
Well, I think I can, I know there is the joke, you know, that it has become a joke. Why do you climb? Because it's there. I can understand the sort of vague but powerful impulse that looking at a mountain would give you. That's the kind of thing that I have felt that, although I have not done any climbing. I wouldn't even know how to start. I wouldn't have the technical background to do it. But this time in my life, I'm not sure I would have the stamina anymore either. So it's a kind of irrational thing. And maybe you would say some people feel it, some people don't. But there is something about it just when you look at it. I am guessing that some people almost in a gut sort of level, they say, I want to go up there. And in a way, there is no real good answer to why, other than I just want to. It's as if something's pulling me. And I guess I have to believe that partly for a lot of people, it's that. And it's almost something that you can't really put into words.
Well, I think you can put it into words. For me, it was very much a kind of exploration. And mountains are among the hardest parts of the earth to explore because they're so dangerous and steep and difficult. And if I think Mallory's comment really does make sense. The bareness of a mountain is the fact that it's staring you in the face and you can see ridges on it and faces and it's there. You do have a basic human urge to know what it would be like to get up to that ledge and make a traverse to the right. For me, in Alaska in the 1960s and 70s, when I was doing my most passionate climbing, virtually everything was unclimbed. All these smaller, very difficult mountains, a lot of them were unnamed. And a huge part of the thrill and motivation had to do with exploring, going places where nobody else had ever been.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I am guessing that there is something that lies behind the motivation that people have to do anything like that extremely difficult, dangerous, and challenging, that part of it does have to do with trying to answer the question, can I do this? It's just a matter of a challenge to the self, saying, whatever the challenge is, I want to see if I can actually do it or not.
Right. And it's an old myth that climbing is not competitive. It actually turns out to be one of the most competitive pastimes I've ever run into. So if you're out of the local cliff, they're the heroes, the guys who can climb the hardest routes. And you, when you're young, you hero worship them and you wish you could get that good. And it matters very much to climbers who did the first ascent of a given route or peak. So it's actually a very competitive sport in which some kind of localized fame counts as a very high reward.
So you're always measuring yourself against other people who are trying to do the same thing.
I think it's inevitable.
Mm-hmm. We have a call already, so why don't I just go ahead and bring them in rather
sure.
than make them wait. Someone who's listening this morning in Indiana on our line 4 toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I guess I don't even know if this is a fair question, but it's something that popped in my mind, mainly because of risk factor. Recently, there have been a number of cases out west where young kids have gone out, and I guess they're not exactly doing mountain climbing, but they get lost and end up dying. And what concerns me, I guess, is the monies the public is paying for you guys to go up sides of mountains, and when you get in trouble, you put other people in danger who are flying the helicopters and trying to reach you with the dogs and stuff. I just think it's, there's preponderance of hubris here. I'd wonder if you could talk about that.
I think it's a very fair question. Hubris is a big part of the climbing urge. In my generation, we tried to stick to a very strong self-imposed principle, which is rescue yourself if you get in trouble. Don't count on other people to rescue you. I've never had to be rescued, and I'm proud of that fact. And you're right, there are an increasing number of not only climbers, but adventurers and hikers of all kinds who spend public money and risk public officials' lives getting rescued. In fact, even in climbing, it's become, at climbing and hiking, things like the cell phone have had a terrible, terrible impact on this, so that people who simply get out and get a little bit wet in a rainstorm will grab the cell phone and call for a helicopter rescue, and this has become the bane of search and rescue outfits. So I agree with you very much.
Well, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the book, you talk about a little bit about your youth and your childhood, and when you were a kid, the kinds of things that you were interested in, and talked about how for a while you were very interested in astronomy. And that you also seemed to have a talent for, a great ability for math. And when you went to college at Harvard, you were going to major in math. And one would expect that with those kinds of interests, you might have gone on to become an astronomer or astrophysicist or some kind of scientist, something like that. Instead of being a journalist and a writer, how do you think that happened, and why is it that you're not an astronomer today, or something else?
Well, I thought I was a whiz kid in math in high school, and going to Harvard let me know just what level I really was at, which was not very good. I could have become a mathematician, but I wouldn't have been a very good one. And I really did have a passion to be excellent at something. And climbing was really the first thing I tried that I was good enough at, and there were few enough people doing it that I could progress to the highest level, at least in this country, that it was being practiced. I also have to tie it to having had a very alienated adolescence and wanting somehow to escape the world of Boulder High School where I grew up. And climbing seemed also to offer the illusion of escape and transcendence, and that was a very important motivation for me.
Mm-hmm. So just the idea of being out there, being alone, getting away, the physical act of doing it sounds as if for you that was a great source of solace almost.
Yeah, you go out with a couple of buddies, and you think at first that you're responsible to no one else. It's just you among the two or three of you that everything's taking place. This is, of course, an illusion, because they're the people waiting back home, the parents, the siblings, the friends, who are terribly worried about you and who go through really irreducible grief when someone dies. And that's perhaps the main reason I wrote the book, was to come to terms with those three fatal accidents I'd been involved in by the age of 22, to wonder why I still kept climbing, and finally to reckon with the moral responsibility of having done such dangerous stuff that got people killed, and try to go back and make some kind of amends to the people who were most wounded by those tragedies.
Well, in that first incident, when you were 18, when you were out climbing with your friend Gabe, and he was killed, was that? And both of you were young. This was early on in your climbing experience, so you know, perhaps this was a matter of inexperience. Perhaps it was a matter of hubris, as the earlier caller said. Was it mostly a matter of hubris and inexperience, and just the kind of mistakes that rookies make, and it just happened to be that this was an extremely dangerous activity where a mistake could cost you your life?
Gabe and I had only been climbing for about 4 months when he was killed on the first Flatiron above Boulder. But the circumstances that led to the accident were really bad luck. It's too complicated to explain on the air. But they involved the rope getting snagged in a place where we couldn't get it loose. I'm not sure to this day what we should have done differently. We could have sat there and called for help and ignominiously been rescued by more senior climbers. But, you know, climbers just don't do that. On the other hand, one thing that I write about is that I hadn't realized what was really going on with Gabe, because only 3 months before his death, his father was killed in a car accident in Texas, and Gabe had grown up without a mother. He was the oldest of three siblings. So suddenly at age 18, actually age 17, he was, in effect, the orphaned head of his family. And this put tremendous psychological pressure on, more pressure than he could bear, I think. And all that I noticed in my naivete and stupidity as an adolescent was that when he came back from his father's funeral, the first thing he said is, when can we go climbing again? And then when we climbed together, he seemed to be climbing brilliantly. What I didn't realize is that he was climbing not only brilliantly, but perhaps a bit desperately. And I think that had everything to do with the terrible turmoil that he was keeping very bottled up inside him.
Mm-hmm. You know, you explained the fact that part of what is behind this book is your interest in looking at these questions, like why people, why you climb, why anybody climbs, how it is you take into account the element of danger, and for you, why it is that after that in these three cases you were involved in climbs where somebody was killed, and this was the first one, why is it that after that you didn't quit, you kept climbing? And I don't know if you feel like you have a good answer, and in fact, partly we've answered it already. But after that first incident, when Gabe was killed, you were 18 years old. I imagine some people would have said, "I'm never going to do this again. It's too dangerous. I might die. Somebody important to me might die. It's not worth it. I'm just not going to do it." And you didn't say that. You continued to climb. Why didn't you just call it quits?
Well, I went a long way towards calling it quits in the 2 months after Gabe's death, which happened during the summer after our having graduated from high school. I had pretty much decided not to climb again. I knew I would hike and backpack, but I was ready to turn my back for good on technical climbing. I went to Harvard and, you know, joined the tennis team and went out for other kinds of activities, and one day wandered by the mountaineering club, the first meeting of the mountaineering club, thinking, well, Harvard's in the east, they don't have any real mountains there, how serious could they be? And I simply had my socks knocked off, because these guys were truly experienced and talented mountaineers. In fact, that at the time, the Harvard club was the most ambitious in the country for undergraduates. And these, I couldn't help it, these guys became my heroes at once. And I joined the club, went out with them, and longed passionately to become their peers and colleagues. If I had gone to a college that didn't have that kind of a mountaineering club, I doubt that I would have continued to climb at all.
I have some other callers here, and let me also introduce our guest. We're talking with David Roberts. He's well known for having written about mountaineering, about adventure generally, also about the history of the American Southwest. He has written 17 books. He's also contributed essays and articles to different publications, including National Geographic and Smithsonian and Atlantic Monthly. And he's author of a new memoir talking about his experiences climbing. As we've said, looking at what are probably about the most basic questions you could ask about climbing mountains, which is why anybody does it and how they think about the danger involved. His book is titled On the Ridge, Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. It is published by Simon Schuster. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get to them. Next caller in Champaign County on line two.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I'm calling because I have a comment. For me, the mountain, or I see the mountain as a metaphor of the male sexual organ. It's another architecture as the penis. And I think I see it like an exploration of the mountain as in a solitary fashion, as Jack in the Bean Stack explores his the stack. It's the exploration of their own body. It's, I think it dips into the psychological aspect. And I don't know why you have ever put it that way, but that's one of my interpretations.
Wow.
Anybody ever suggested that before?
No, I've never had that comment before. I mean,
okay,
I don't know.
I'm just going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, mountains do, some of the steepest ones are very phallic looking, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's not simply a crazy question. There's a lot of testosterone going on in the world of mountain climbing, and in my day, there were very few women doing it. So it was a very male-centered pursuit. Actually, today, something like 30 to 40% of all climbers are women. But I suppose the real answer to that lies deep in the subconscious, and I'm not competent to answer it.
Well, it seems to go back to what we were talking about a little earlier, and that there's something here going on that's not exclusive to men. Some attraction to danger, perhaps, some attraction to the physical challenge, the ability to say, I have done something, I can do something that not everyone can do. And then even among the community of people who do that, this desire for one person to say, I'm better than you, I'm stronger than you, I've climbed higher than you, I've done stuff. that you haven't done. There seems to be this really strong rivalry. So it's challenging yourself. It may be challenging the elements. It may be challenging other people. But it seems like it's all about, it's all one way or another about challenging.
Right.
And that's not just a male thing.
No, especially today, it's not just a male thing. Mm. And it's not just in 50 years ago, the language of climbing was riddled with military metaphors. You conquer the mountain. It's a victory. It's a triumph. You lay siege to the peak. But a later generation has rebelled against that kind of language, and argued that you don't conquer a mountain. You have to live in harmony with it to climb it. So there's been a whole shift of sensibility about that.
Does that difference in the basic attitude, does that make a difference in how it is you approach, in a technical sense, how you approach climbing? And then if one of your big concerns is whether you live or die, can the attitude, the mindset you approach with, can that make a difference?
Absolutely. One reason women have flocked to climbing recently is that they can be very good at it, because it requires grace and balance and limberness as much as it requires strength. Women are often excellent climbers because perhaps more in touch with their bodies that way. If you climb simply relying on your arms, for instance, you won't get up anything. It's much more like ballet. You have to carefully place your feet and be aware of your balance and make very subtle motions. And if you're fighting the mountain or the cliff, you're not going to get up it. It does require a kind of blending with it and accepting its moods and accepting the weather and being in harmony with the elements.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to offer a comment. I tuned in a little late. I'm sorry if you already perhaps mentioned this. But I think it's really interesting to talk about the philosophical reasons of climbing mountains. For me, at least, I've found very logical answers in evolutionary biology, and that, in short, generations ago, the members of cultures and society that would go out and explore new territory and challenge themselves and find new hunting grounds and new tribes with which to interbreed would have more successful offspring, and that need is instilled in our generation today. And so, anyway, I'll go back to listening on the air. I just wanted to offer that for comment. Thank you.
All right. Well,
it's an interesting point. I do think that the urge to explore new territory is built into our genes, and it may have been mainly a male prerogative in the Paleolithic, when the men hunted, as far as we know, and the women took care of the families. On the other hand, you could say that it's a kind of misguided object for that evolutionary impulse. It doesn't do the tribe any good to climb a mountain. And in fact, my favorite climbing autobiography is Lionel Terray's Conquistadors of the Useless. This is a rather awkward title, but it really captures something about climbing. What we may be conquistadors of is an utterly useless realm in terms of getting on with day-to-day life.
You know, I had just last week on the show, I had the chance to talk with Johann Reinhard, who is a mountaineering archaeologist.
Yeah, I know Johann pretty well.
You know?
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about, he's now got a book out that is about some of the work that he's done in the Andes, investigating these high-altitude burials of the Inca.
I actually went on one of those expeditions with him.
Really? There are some of the pictures in the book, and they're just really remarkable, particularly some of those pictures of what it's like to be standing on top of some of those mountains, where we're looking at around 20,000 feet. So that's a pretty respectable mountain. And one of the things that we mentioned almost just in passing was that it seems that almost universally people regard mountains as being sacred. There is this idea that the mountains are where the gods are, And that's a special realm. Perhaps if you've, I'm, my guess is if you stand on top of a 20,000 foot mountain, you'd understand that feeling pretty well. Do you think that notion, that almost mystical notion about mountains has anything to do with the pole and why it is that some people want to climb?
Yeah, I'm an agnostic myself, at least, maybe an atheist, and have not had any sense of connection with a godhead on a mountain. But it's absolutely unquestionable that it's a spiritual experience. And you're right, mountains all over the world have been deemed sacred by the people who lived around them, often to the result that they are forbidden to climb them. Many sacred mountains are off limits to humans, which is an interesting counter attitude toward that, to that of the climber. What Reinhard was discovering, which I think is the hardest archaeology ever performed on the surface of the earth, he was discovering Inca sacrifices on the tops of 20,000-foot mountains. And, yeah, the mountains were sacred to the Incas, but what the Incas seemed to have been doing there was taking young boys and girls, marching them to the tops of the mountains and killing them, perhaps as a way of intimidating their vassal states. So it's actually a fairly creepy phenomenon that he's discovered and documented.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also seemed to be making the argument, and I guess no, it's uncertain exactly what this was about, though making the argument that what the Inca thought that they were doing with these children was they were making an offering to the gods, and they were also sending envoys, and that for the people who were left behind, they became something almost like a saint, in a sense, in Christianity, that they would be an intermediary between the their people, their families, and
true,
the people back on the earth, and the gods, and that, in fact, that the children would become like gods themselves.
Yep.
Now, and obviously here it's very difficult for us with our cultural values and our perspective to put ourselves in that kind of mindset to see how it is those people would see that. But that seemed to be his suggestion about what it was this was all about.
Right. Johann believes that it's entirely possible that the sacrificial victims hiked up the mountains in an ecstatic state,
mm-hmm,
glad to be so chosen.
Well, anyway, if people want to read that book, it's that he's written about this. The title of the book is The Ice Maiden. And also, if people want to hear that interview, if they didn't hear it first time around, they can go to our web archives and they can hear it. Again, hear questions as we talk on this program with David Roberts. He's a writer who specializes particularly in writing about mountaineering, about mountain climbing, also about adventure, also the history of the American Southwest. His new book is a memoir of his climbing experiences, On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. In the book, you make note of the fact that some years ago, I guess this would be in 1980, you wrote a magazine article which you say today is probably the thing that you're best known for. It's been anthologized. It was titled Moments of Doubt. And what it was an attempt for you to, in a sense, answer the same questions that you're wrestling with in this book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death. Why climb and how you think about the danger. And that at that point that you offered some kind of answers, the answers that you had to give in 1980, and that now, 20 years, almost 20 years later, as you continue to think about it and work on what ended up this project, that you started to have second thoughts about what you had written in Moments of Doubt. And in part, you write here that because of the way people reacted to it. Now, I haven't had the chance to read it. Maybe can you talk a little bit about what you wrote in Moments of Doubt, and then maybe I'll ask you to talk about how you have come to some reassessment of that.
Sure. Thanks for asking the question. The three accidents happened between 1961 and 1965, so that when I was writing Moments of Doubt, I was looking back on them from 15 years' vantage point. And I was essentially trying to write an apologia, an explanation for continuing to climb, and it was all centered around, is it worth the risk? That was my central question, and I ended up saying, yeah, it is worth the risk, because the joys and the highs I've gotten are so high and so lasting and so meaningful to me that they outweigh the terrible things that have happened. 10 or 15 years after I published that piece, which has struck a chord with lots of readers, I started thinking, well, no, wait a minute. This is a very self-centered answer, because all I'm doing is consulting myself. And it took me that long, believe it or not, obtuse as I was, to realize that you can't answer the question, is it worth the risk, only by consulting your own heart and soul. You have to really know what your climbing costs other people. And that led to a much more skeptical explanation in my book. Maybe this book is an anti-apologia. I certainly had always been disappointed at other climbers' justifications for climbing, because they were equally narcissistic and self-centered. And I wanted to raise questions that I didn't feel climbers had ever really faced before about moral responsibility to others in particular.
Let us go and talk again with somebody who was listening here. That would be a caller in Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a comment and a question. Mark Twight enjoyed climbing because he found it reduced the subtleties in his life to black and white. Life became black and white. There was no questions of if he was doing the right thing, because if he survived, he was. And psychology has found that people feel their best when they feel a challenge and their feedback is instantaneous. And rock climbing is an exact example of that. And so those are some of the things why I am attracted to climbing. And then I had a question, and I was wondering if the guest thought that some of his accidents there were fatalities, if those were due to equipment that has since been outdated by modern trad climbing equipment.
Complicated question. I think your point about Mark Twight's approach is very well taken, although I don't agree with Twight's rather melodramatic angst about his own life as a climber. I know Mark, but I think the point that it reduces his life to a black and white yes and no choice and drama is very important, very well taken. And yes, psychologically that's more comforting than the kind of ambiguous muddle of normal everyday life. What was the second part?
About the trad equipment.
In the case of the accident on Mount Washington, the second of the two, I think it's unmistakable that Dan Doody and Craig Merrihew were killed partly because of a bad ice screw, the kind that we don't use anymore. And even in the third accident on Mount Huntington, it may have been a bad carabiner that caused the accident. It's certainly true that the better equipment that climbers use today has made this sport a lot safer.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. I suppose one might also ask whether the perception that it is safer actually means that people might be taking greater risk. I don't know if the numbers of people who are killed or injured are any greater today than they were 20 years ago. I don't know.
That's another good point. I wouldn't say it's the perception that it's safer so much as the fact that it's become more competitive, so that people will deliberately do without a lot of the equipment or techniques that could make it safe in order to still be pushing the limits. What we call free soloing, climbing without a rope solo, was hardly done at all in my heyday, and now it's a big deal for the best climbers in the world. And that's pushing the game to the very limit, because if you slip, you die. Mm-hmm. And people are doing stuff like that in the Himalayas now that is really out there. So I don't think it's a misperception about safety. I think it's the fact that climbing is not the same game without risk. Risk is an integral part of the game, and the sharper the risk, maybe the better certain fanatical types feel about themselves.
Once you've had a brush with death, I suppose that some people would say, I'm never going to do this again.
Well, sane people would say.
Sane people. Okay, good. Sane people would say, I'm never going to do this again. Other people of questionable sanity keep doing it. And that, you know, that also makes you wonder, is there something about the brush with death that has an addictive quality? And once you've had the feelings, maybe it's the feeling of relief that comes when you know you've survived that makes you want to push it. And is there some way that you end up wanting to feel that again?
Well, I think it's, first of all, one would feel very foolish if you thought you knew that climbing was dangerous, then you witnessed or involved in a fatal accident and you said, oh, gee, I should never have been doing this. It would be like admitting that your life had been ruled by a mistake. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of denial going on there. I also make the analogy with war and being a good soldier that and a lot of people have pointed out the similarities between mountaineering and war. The good soldier in classic army terms is the guy who can see his buddy killed right beside him and snatch up his rifle and charge on toward the enemy. Whereas a more human response would be to collapse, would be to burst into tears and sit there sobbing if your buddy was killed beside you. But that's not what the Army wants its good soldiers to do, and that's not what good climbers ever seem to do. I write a lot about other climbers in my book because I've learned a lot from interviewing them and reading their works. And I'm struck by the coldness of climbing memoirs, by the lip service paid to tragedy that never feels very sincere or genuine to me. And I think we've got a good soldier kind of mentality going on there that, well, buck up, get on with it, steal your softer feelings against really letting that sadness penetrate.
Hmm. I guess that invites the question whether you think that the experience of climbing over time does that to you or it attracts people who are like that already.
Both. One of my chapters is called Hard Man, and it's a British, jocular British term from the 50s. A hard man, it's a term of complete praise without irony. A hard man is a guy who doesn't let either pain or discomfort or tragedy interfere with climbing harder and harder. And I write about how I came from being the uncertain and scared teenager who was just absolutely flattened by Gabe's death on the Flatiron to the hard man who accepted death as part of the game and for some 10 years just went at it harder and harder in Alaska every summer. Mm-hmm. I feel now that that's a very bad model for what makes for character. I've always resisted the idea that climbing is a school of character. I think the kind of character you learn in climbing is very ill-adapted to the rest of life.
We have about 15 minutes left, and let me introduce again our guest, David Roberts. He's well known for writing about mountain climbing, about adventure, also about the history of the American Southwest. He's the author of 17 books. He began climbing while he was still in high school. He was president of the Harvard Mountaineering Club and has contributed essays and articles to a number of publications, including the National Geographic and Smithsonian and the Atlantic Monthly. And his book, his memoir about his experiences climbing and what they mean, is On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. And it's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions are welcome, certainly. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You talk in the book about how when you were just starting out learning to climb when you're living in Boulder, that what you did was you went out with experienced climbers and tried to learn from them. They tried to teach you how to do, and that then fairly soon after that, they kind of turned you loose, and maybe before you should have been. But that also raises the question about climbing, how much you can actually be taught by somebody else, and how much learning to be a climber really is learning by experience, and that the way you do it is you just have to go out and do it.
Yeah. We took a course, Gabe and I, that consisted of only 5 Saturdays in a row, and then we were certified as climbers and sent loose to do what we wanted to do. And when I think back on it, I shudder at how ill-prepared we were. On the other hand, It's an irony that most of the great climbers in the world were self-taught. Some didn't even have those five lessons. A lot of climbers stole a clothesline and found a few pitons and went out in sneakers and just tried to figure out how it works. And it's kind of an adage of our trade that if you survive the youthful follies of that apprenticeship, you could go on to become a good climber. The counter-irony is that the really careful, stodgy, slow programs to teach climbing don't tend to produce very good climbers.
Well, is it today much the same? Are there better... If you decided what I want to do is go to school and to learn how to climb, are better places now, maybe some better training now than there would have been in the past?
Oh, incalculably better. Probably the best way to learn to climb today is to hire a competent guide and have him teach you everything. And there's so many good... There was no such profession as a professional mountain climber guide in the 60s. They're all over the country today, and a lot of them are really, really excellent at teaching beginners. That's the way to learn, and that's probably the safest and the best way to master the craft today.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with somebody else here. We have a caller, someone listening in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in British Columbia in the late 60s and 70s hiking off trail and things like that, and I know at the time I was very much driven by adventure stories you'd read when you were a kid, and Lewis and Clark and Hillary, and, you know, this idea that you were striking out into the wilderness and discovering something new in that. And at a certain point, I kind of realized that the whole, other than personal enjoyment, there really was no purpose to it. And I think this is maybe what you're getting at in terms of it being a sort of a narcissistic thing is, there was a time when this sort of stuff had a purpose. It had a purpose for society. You were discovering a pass for people to get a shorter route somewhere, or discovering a new land, or it actually had a broader purpose than other than just, it's really nice to be up here and looking at the view. And I would kind of suggest that, like a lot of graphic arts these days, it had a real practical purpose at one point, and now really it doesn't, other than it's certainly very enjoyable to be up there and out there, but I would suggest that that's sort of the core of it really is pointless other than just to have fun for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. That's why Terray calls his book Conquistadors of the Useless. I make a point in my book that in the Renaissance, if you asked an explorer why he was going to the New World, he would have a very ready answer. He didn't have to get metaphysical about it. It was to win fame and fortune, and if he was a Franciscan friar, to convert the heathen savages. I've actually just recently been exploring Fremont ruins, prehistoric ruins in central Utah for a magazine assignment, where these guys in the 10th to 13th century did phenomenal climbing. And it was not for fun. It was because somebody was trying to steal their corn, and they had to put granaries way up on cliffs in places where nobody could get to them. And they were driven to climb at an extraordinarily high level by something that mattered to everybody in the tribe, saving the corn, avoiding starving to death. A lot of the climbing in history and exploring has been done with truly social good as an end in view.
In the book, you talk about it, how at this point in your life, you wouldn't say that you were a serious climber anymore. You're probably not going to be climbing any 20,000-foot mountains, but that you still climb and that you'd never let more than maybe a few months go by without going out and trying to do some climbing. It sounds as if your views maybe scaled back in some sense, but that it has become so much a part of your fundamental identity that it's just simply something that you have to do.
Right. Well, of course, I'm 62 years old now, and no 62-year-old can climb like a 25-year-old. So partly it's just physical and psychological. But I do feel that the finest friendships of my life have been forged climbing. And one of the things that keeps me climbing is the chance to go out with old buddies and do easy or mellow or moderate routes and just have a high old time doing it. Most of us climbers who have stopped being fanatic try to seek a kind of mellow, happy tailing down of our craft. But just last summer, I went to the Dolomites with five of my oldest climbing buddies. And for 2 weeks, we did moderate routes and hiked and drank beer and just had a wonderful time, the kind of imperishable comradeship you can hardly get, mm-hmm. say, playing golf.
The one of the purposes of the book, as we've talked here off and on, was to think about the risks of climbing and whether or not they're worth it. And the fact that maybe you have to consider that you're not just talking about yourself, the risk to yourself. You're talking about what happens if you get hurt or you die, and what that means to all the people to whom you are important. And so what you did was you went out and you tried to spend some time talking with the survivors of the people who died on these three climbs that we're talking about. How were you received when you came knocking on these people's door?
Well, it was pretty intense. In particular, I visited Gabe's sister and brother, who were younger, 39 years after he died. And I found that Marion, the sister in particular, had harbored an intense anger against me all through those 39 years. And what she had to say to me was shocking, really hard to absorb, and ultimately incredibly valuable for me. I write about it in the last chapter. And I deeply regret that I didn't perform that task much, much earlier.
She thought,
save her a lot of her pain.
She thought it was your fault somehow.
Yeah, she had never understood the accident because the papers got it completely messed up, their explanation of it. She wasn't a climber. She thought somehow I had committed a fatal error that had cost Gabe his life. But even after I explained the accident to her, I could see that she somehow wasn't buying it. She uttered this really memorable formula. I said, do you still have to blame someone for the accident? And she said, yes. And I said, who? And she said, I blame you 30%. I blame Gabe 30%. I blame God 30%. And maybe the other 10% is luck.
Going back to what is the major question, and here you really talked about it a little earlier, but if I could get you to talk about it again, and that is the question, is the risk worth it? And you talked about the fact that earlier in your life you might have offered one answer, and you would have found ways to justify answering that question in the affirmative. You know, you could have found a way to say, yeah, the risk is worth it. So now, with this much more perspective and having gone through this painful and difficult exercise of actually talking with the survivors of people who you climbed with and were killed. So now, how do you answer the question, is the risk worth it?
I think I'm not going to say it simply that it's not worth it. I think the answer is sheer ambivalence. I can't decide. As I say in the very end of the book, the greatest joys of my life have come from climbing, and the first ascents I did in Alaska are the things I'm most proud of ever having done in life, and yet those aren't the ultimate criteria by which you judge the worth of a life.
How, suppose some, I don't know, you have children?
No.
You don't have children.
I don't think I could have done this if I had children.
Well, I guess I wonder about, you know, that and just sort of the general question, if there was some young person who was important to you, child, niece, nephew, grandchild, you know, whatever, or maybe somebody who even wasn't a blood relative at all, who came and said to you, I want to do this. I want to climb. Would you say, don't? Would you say, okay, but I want you to know what you're getting into? Would you, how would you advise someone who was bitten by the bug the way that you were when you were a teenager?
I think that you have to say that middle formula, okay, but make sure you know what you're getting into. And one way to know is to read about climbing catastrophes and sort out what made them happen and what impacts they did have. You should not go into it blind, thinking that, oh, wow, this is cool. and it's safe because people say it is, it's not the kind of thing to enter casually. You don't pick it up as a hobby the way you might pick up, oh, touch football or street basketball, just because the potential consequences are so high.
Well, I think we're about the point where we're going to have to stop. And I guess I would say to people who are listening, for anyone who is interested in some answer, at least one man's answer to that question, why it is people climb mountains, you can look at the book that we have been talking about. It's titled On the Ridge Between Life and Death, A Climbing Life Reexamined. And it's published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest David Roberts. He's written 17 books dealing with mountaineering, but also other adventure subjects, and also the history of the American Southwest. And he's also contributed to National Geographic and Smithsonian, the Atlantic Monthly. The book, On the Ridge Between Life and Death, out there now in the bookstores. And Mr. Roberts, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.